the British Prime Minister is not giving up.
There is only one way to get Brexit done in the face of this unrelenting parliamentary obstructionism.
And what way is that, Mr. Johnson? You take Brexit back to the people, of course. Brits are getting another say at the ballot box. And Iran has had success at winning battles and elections.
However, they never thought of what's going to happen next. It turned out that Iran is really bad at governing, at ruling.
Trying to understand Iran's connection to the protests in Lebanon and Iraq. Also, tracking animals from space.
We didn't wake up one morning and say, oh boy, let's count hippos from space.
Forget counting hippos from space. Scientists are now counting whales. I'm Carol Hills. Whales from space and more coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Boris Johnson is rolling the dice. The British Prime Minister had been pushing for a national election, and now he's got it. The vote is scheduled for December 12th, so it's back to the campaign trail for Johnson's Conservative Party to make the case for Brexit. Polls indicate that Johnson's party is solidly ahead of the main opposition Labour Party. But wait a second. This is Brexit, and that means it's impossible to guess how this will all eventually shake out. Here's The World's Orla Barry in London.
In Britain, elections do not come every 4 years like they do in the US. Politicians here set the date for a national vote strategically. The idea is to choose the right time and give your party the best chance for success at the polls. What could possibly go wrong?
The headlines this morning. After tumultuous election night, the UK has a hung parliament. Theresa May's decision to call an election has backfired, with the Conservatives short of an overall Commons majority.
Prime Minister May failed spectacularly in 2017. Brexit was ultimately her downfall. But Boris Johnson seems to think that history will not repeat itself.
There is only one way to get Brexit done in the face of this unrelenting parliamentary obstructionism. This endless, willful, fingers crossed, not me, Gov refusal to deliver on the mandate of the people. And that is, Mr. Speaker, to refresh this parliament and give the people a choice.
The main opposition leader is Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party. He's not just focusing on Brexit. Corbyn promises a progressive future for Britain, focused on income inequality, climate change and improved government services.
I'm very ready to go out there and give that message in any election whenever it comes.
But just how much of a risk is all this for Boris Johnson? He's the front runner in the polls, with a solid 11-point lead for his Conservative Party over Labour. That might sound encouraging, but Rob Watson, the BBC's senior political correspondent, says this is a high-risk strategy for the Conservatives.
Brexit has admitted, if you like, a shock to the British political system, to voters. Another factor that's worth remembering, and that is voter volatility in the UK. I mean, it used to be in the good old days that people were amazingly loyal to their parties, but now people switch parties. I don't know, in the way that they might switch kind of brands of washing powder. So, it is an inherently very risky approach.
Come polling day, there are usually a number of key issues that influence people's decisions. Healthcare and immigration were the big ones last time round. This time, though, it seems there really is just one issue.
Look, Brexit is this oversized elephant in this very tiny room. I mean, the entire reason why the election is happening is because Britain's politicians couldn't agree what to do about the results of the referendum in 2016. Certainly, the governing Conservatives, Mr. Johnson, wants to make it about Brexit. Some of those parties which are out-and-out anti-Brexit parties, they absolutely want to make it about Brexit and to say this is your last chance to stop Britain leaving the EU to the voters.
There's another problem with scheduling an election in mid-December. It's a couple of weeks before Christmas, for starters, but this will also be Britain's third election in 4 years. And it's fair to say that the public here is already suffering with considerable Brexit fatigue. The BBC talked to some voters on the streets of Birmingham this week, and they're not sure another election will bring much change.
I think politically at the moment everything is obviously a mess, and it has been a mess for a couple of years. I think the country just want a bit of stability now. I'm not sure whether an election can give that.
Brexit is a different issue. If it happens, if it doesn't happen, my main point of concern is however we take the country forward.
Possibly we're going to get virtually nowhere with a Christmas election.
The campaign is only a little over 5 weeks long, but it looks like it could be a deeply divisive one. This week, opposition MP Heidi Allen with the Liberal Democrats announced she's not running for re-election because of the abuse she's been getting.
The unbelievable amount of loss of privacy and nastiness that's out there. You are attacked on a daily basis, on email, on social media, people shout at you in the street. It's become absolutely vile. I thought I could carry on. I had a particularly nasty email last week, and I thought, you know what? Nobody in their working place should have to put up with this.
No matter what happens with the vote in December, the British public will have to put up with the Brexit issue for some time to come. The latest Brexit deadline is January 31st of next year. And even if Brexit does happen, it'll only be the beginning of a long, complicated process of leaving the European Union once and for all. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Millions of people around the world rely on WhatsApp to send encrypted messages and make phone calls. Back in May, around 1,400 users received a mysterious video call. It installed malware on their phones, whether they answered the call or not. WhatsApp says it now knows who was behind this, an Israeli cyber intelligence company called NSO. WhatsApp filed a complaint in U.S. federal court against the company this week. John Scott Railton helped WhatsApp chase down people who were attacked. He's a senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto.
Well, there are two discoveries here. One is the discovery made by Citizen Lab, and the other, a discovery made by WhatsApp. Talking about WhatsApp for a second, they had been looking into the possibility that weird things were going on in the way that their app connected calls, and they found something. And what they found was that a private spyware company had been deploying this technology for hacking telephones through WhatsApp. So that doesn't mean hacking WhatsApp messages. That means leveraging WhatsApp to deliver a malicious payload. WhatsApp then closed the vulnerability and told the world about it. Then over the past several months, Citizen Lab volunteered to work with WhatsApp to try to understand who was targeted.
Can you name any of them, the organizations or types of people, or are you keeping mum on that?
What I can tell you is that the victims included human rights defenders, journalists investigating official corruption, broadcast journalists working on international issues, prominent women in multiple countries who were the victims of cyber violence. In other words, a who's who of the kind of people that authoritarian states want to bug if they get the ability to do so.
And were they being targeted in particular countries, or was it people all over the world?
It was people all over the world. The cases that we're talking about today include targets in over 20 countries in four continents.
And what kind of countries? Is there a common theme to any of them?
I would say that the most common theme is actually among the victims, which is these are people who have often pushed back against authoritarian or unaccountable official behavior and been rewarded by being targeted for it.
Now, WhatsApp is accusing NSO Group, an Israeli-based cyber intelligence company, of committing the attack. Who and what is NSO?
NSO Group is a firm that sells to governments, they claim, the ability to remotely hack and monitor telephones. They've been doing this for a while, and for as long as they really have been active, Citizen Lab and researchers at Amnesty International have been finding cases where their powerful products get abused to target members of civil society, like human rights defenders and journalists. The product that they sell, that they're most well known for, is something called Pegasus. And Pegasus is basically a technology for turning a telephone into in your pocket into a spy in your pocket. It can read your encrypted messages, listen to your encrypted phone calls, siphon off your personal photographs, and also do things like quietly activating the microphone while your phone is in your pocket.
Now, is it even legal for NSO Group to produce such technology?
Well, this is a great question. And the world of companies like NSO that peddle this sort of spyware has this interesting and, until yesterday, quite unaccountable niche, which is, on the one hand, they claim that because they're selling to governments, we should trust them. At the same time, when their products get abused, they say, well, this was our government customers doing this. Don't look at us. But they're quick to cite successes, of course, never with any detail. Snap's lawsuit yesterday basically pierces that bubble and says, first of all, NSO was directly involved in these cases. And second of all, you can't be unaccountable if you sell this kind of powerful technology with this potential for being used and abused.
How pervasive is this Pegasus technology? I mean, how worried should we be?
I think we can assume that the actual use of this kind of technology, although not spectacular, is quite a bit larger than the companies would have us believe, which should make us all extremely concerned.
John Scott Railton is a senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you so much.
This next story is about looking for a needle in a haystack, a very large needle in a very large haystack. Here's the world's Amanda McGowan.
Whales are big. So big, in fact, that you can actually see them from outer space, with high-quality satellite cameras, of course. The New England Aquarium in Boston and Draper, a technology company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, are tracking whale migration patterns with those satellites.
This isn't just, air quotes, counting whales from space.
Sheila Hamami is the director of global challenges at Draper. What she means is you can't just point a satellite at Earth and expect it to get exactly what you need. The ocean is huge. It would be like typing whales into a Google search. You're going to get so much information. So John Irvine, the chief scientist for data analytics at Draper, says you have to narrow your search. And they're collecting lots of data from ocean sensors to do that.
What are the conditions that we can observe in the ocean that are favorable to whales? What are the right temperatures? What are the right currents? What are the right presence of plankton and other things that we can see chemically in the ocean surface? And they use that to predict where we think the whales are likely to be at any given time.
Once you have that information, you can say, okay, here is what we'd expect under normal circumstances. And if satellite images show deviation from that, like if there are way fewer whales than you'd thought there would be, that's a red flag. And for people looking to protect whale populations, this information is invaluable. Here's Vicky Spruill, the head of the New England Aquarium. She says that in the case of North Atlantic right whales, a species that's in critical danger of extinction, better tracking may be key to their survival.
If we know where they are, we can protect them and we can create changes in shipping lanes, but we can also protect more of the ocean in the form of marine protected areas.
Draper has actually used this technique before to track hippos in Zambia. Here's Sheila Hamami again.
We didn't wake up one morning and say, oh boy, let's count hippos from space. We were approached by some wildlife conservation organizations about the urgency of getting a count of the hippos in the Luangwa River Valley this summer, because at the time the government had decided that they were going to cull the hippos. And there was some urgency to get a count, and neither the resources nor the time available to use the traditional methods.
Using eyes-in-the-sky technology gives researchers information even when they're not able to get boots on the ground. Traditionally, whales are tracked from boats and planes, and that can be both expensive and dangerous. This technology has a lot of other applications, too. For example, archaeologists can use it to track sites in conflict zones. And that's the beauty of satellites, says John Irvine. You can use them in so many different ways.
It is truly amazing the things that you can see when you have satellites that can collect imagery looking down at the Earth. I think it's going to revolutionize the way we think about our world.
For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
The Lebanese prime minister resigned. Protests are raging across Iraq, and all of this ties back to Iran. We untangle the confusing threads of a fraught situation in the Middle East. That's just ahead. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Iraq and Lebanon have been rocked by huge protests in recent weeks. Demonstrators in both countries have a lot in common. They're railing against corruption and inequality, and many of the politicians they dislike are backed by Iran. Hanid Haddar has been connecting the dots in an article in Foreign Policy. Haddar is a visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Hanin, your article is headlined, Iran is Losing the Middle East. What's the essence of your argument?
Hello, Carol. What I'm trying to say is that Iran, although they are still in control of the political and state institutions, Iran have lost everything else that can back its political power in Lebanon and Iraq. So what I'm trying to say is that Iran has been very good at winning military battles, and they have also been great at winning elections and infiltrating state institutions. However, they never thought of what's going to happen next. It turned out
that Iran is really bad at governing, at ruling. They have been backing corrupt politicians in order to infiltrate state institutions, and the people in the street have noticed that. And today, it is not a coincidence that the protests in Lebanon, Iraq started as a protest against corruption and eventually turned into protest against Iran proxies in both Lebanon and Iraq. This is not a coincidence.
And I just want to remind our listeners that both Lebanon and Iraq have large populations of Shiite Muslims, and that's where Iran gets its influence in these countries.
Lebanon and Iraq are different. Lebanon has 30% Shia within the Lebanese population. Iraq has majority Shia. And what's fascinating about these two protests is that the Shia are at the core of these protests. Iran is not only losing its corrupt allies in these two countries, it's also losing its Shia support base.
So I guess a shorthand for your argument is that Iran and its proxies in places like Lebanon and Iraq know how to win wars and they know how to gain political power, but they can't seem to deliver on the economy. Is it kind of the old saying, it's the economy, stupid?
Yes, kind of.
But Hezbollah has done a lot more than just be involved in politics. I mean, they've had lots of social programs and medical care and all sorts of things that would seem to address the concerns of Lebanese. And that went back in the 1980s, 1990s. But you're arguing that Iran, through its proxies like Hezbollah, have failed to deliver a social and economic vision.
Of course. How? Of course, because two things here. One is that this was a long time ago, and they only catered for the Shia. They did not really cater for the Lebanese people. They catered for the Shia population because this is how they wanted to get the Shia political support base. The second important thing is that these services are no longer catering for the Shia. They do not have the same funds that they used to have 20 or 30 years ago. Today, they are only catering for their members and the families of their members, which is not the Shia community. So that's why they failed.
The U.S. has almost strangled Iran's oil exports. As a result, Iran's revenues have fallen catastrophically. How has that impacted cash flows to Iran's proxies in Iraq and Syria, the very people we've been talking about?
Yes, definitely. This has definitely contributed to Hezbollah's crisis, their financial crisis. They have stopped serving the majority of the Shia population. They couldn't employ people anymore. They started firing employees. And they have started to think, to reconsider every step they make in terms of a war with Israel or more military adventures in the region because they cannot afford to have these wars. So this has affected them, tied their hands in terms of military adventures, and also it started to create discontent within the Shia community who are no longer benefiting from Hezbollah's services and employment.
So could we be seeing a gradual shift in Iran's influence in places like Iraq and Lebanon, given these protests, given the fact that the traditional ways of propping up proxies isn't working?
We are already seeing this shift. Hezbollah today in Lebanon is a very, very difficult position. The Iranian-backed militias in Iraq are also in a very difficult position. They have lost their people. And this is a very important pillar in their political power and public support.
Hanin Khadar with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks a lot.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Earlier this hour, we told you how the British Parliament is preoccupied with Brexit and elections. In the middle of all this, a group of female parliamentarians found time to send a letter of solidarity to Meghan Markle, the wife of Prince Harry. She's been in a battle with the British tabloids, and some say the coverage goes beyond the normal nastiness to racism. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Meghan Markle decided to take all of that British stiff upper lip stuff and throw it out the window. In a documentary released last week, she was open about the emotional toll of being in the media spotlight.
It's hard. When I first met my now husband, my friends were really happy because I was so happy. But my British friend said to me, I'm sure he's great, but you shouldn't do it because the British tabloids will destroy your life.
Since that interview, Meghan and Harry have filed lawsuits against three newspapers. And now, 71 women lawmakers are giving Meghan a vote of support. In the letter, they call out some of the stories about Meghan for having, quote, outdated colonial undertones. Meghan is biracial. And they say, as women in public life, they share an understanding of the abuse and intimidation. MP Rupa Huck told the British network ITV why she signed the letter.
She's someone from a foreign country. She's relocated. She's a woman of colour. And that's part of why we thought that the way that our tabloid press treats her is kind of almost neo-colonial, that she should be someone who should get back in her box, not have opinions.
Huck said neo-colonial just there. The letter says colonial undertones. But Michelle Ruiz, a journalist who's written about Meghan Markle, has another word for it.
The coverage is racist. When people are talking about it, they dance and skate around that word so much. It's almost like it's such a dirty word, even when there is a very clear and obvious pattern of racism in the coverage.
Ruiz says the racism began the minute Meghan started dating Harry, with headlines like, "Harry's girl is straight out of Compton." And she says it's continued over the past 3 years.
It has really run the gamut, I think, from picking her apart, accusing her of being a bridezilla, accusing her of being demanding and difficult with her staff.
In a lot of this coverage, Ruiz sees the racist stereotype of the angry black woman. And she points out that Meghan draws an excessive amount of negative coverage, especially compared to her white sister-in-law, Kate Middleton.
There is an attitude behind all this of bristling at a woman of color being in these sort of elevated and vaunted positions.
For their part, several British tabloids have denied there are any racist overtones to their coverage of Meghan Markle. As for the letter of support, Meghan's office says she's aware of it, though she's choosing not to comment. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're with The World. Hong Kong protesters now have a blacklist. On it, companies that are pro-Beijing. Their store windows have been smashed.
It's a well-defined strategy to punish any corporation that is aligned with the Chinese government, which is effectively the enemy of the protesters.
Hooliganism or a successful form of protest? That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Russian President Vladimir Putin has a lot of influence. One man that seems to be under his spell, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Putin and Orban sat down today in Budapest to discuss a proposed pipeline that would connect the two countries. Katalin Cech is in Budapest. She's a founding member of the Hungarian opposition party Momentum Movement. She told us about the tight relationship between the two men.
Mr. Orban has publicly stated on many occasions that he sees Mr. Putin as a role model, that he does not believe in the functioning of the European model of democracy. Probably he also sees himself as a balance between NATO and the Western Alliance and the countries more on the East. So therefore, that also raises some questions in his dedication towards NATO and the transatlantic partnership.
Now, it's been reported that Viktor Orban might have actually pushed President Trump to turn against Ukraine. Why might he want Trump to do that?
Mr. Orban has had an agenda with Ukraine for a while. He claims to do this in order to protect the Hungarian minority living in Ukraine. But the truth is that all of his geopolitical operations always play in the hand of Russia, always cater for the interests of the Russian leadership.
Orban and his far-right Fidesz party, they didn't fare well in recent elections. Why was that?
Well, this recent local election was a great victory for the opposition. We claim almost all large cities of Hungary. It clearly shows that Hungarians are fed up with the Orban-style governance and they preferred the united opposition, a more positive, a more European, and a more green agenda.
Do you think there's fear among Orban's party that the power is slipping away?
Well, they never suffered such a big loss under his governance. So it's clear that they are trying to pursue a more aggressive agenda against the opposition in the coming years. They see that the numbers are not working for them, that they lost a great part of their popular support. In the campaign trail, he openly stated that every city that elects an opposition mayor will be stripped from EU funds, will be stripped from development assistance. So we are afraid that he will actually go forward in implementing these punishments towards the cities that chose to reject Fidesz leadership.
Now, we're talking to you from the offices of your own opposition party, Momentum Movement. And this morning, those offices were raided by Hungarian tax officials. What was that about?
So this morning, the agents of the criminal branch of the Hungarian National Tax Authority indeed raided the offices of our party and also our bookkeeper's office. They seized several documents. According to them, they are looking for an evidence of criminal activity in the pending criminal case. Probably it will be clearly linked to an earlier operation when they suspended our state aid and finances after the national elections took place. But after a lengthy procedure, we were cleared. We are open to cooperate with the authorities, but we are afraid that this is indeed an abuse of power.
Katalin, do you think that the raiding of your office was done on orders of, you know, someone as high as Viktor Orban?
I cannot say that for sure, but it's clear that also in the past, state authorities were very aggressive in their approach of mishandling opposition parties that appear to be strong in that moment. This is not the first instance where tax authorities are used for political purposes. So we are very much afraid that indeed the authorities are in the hand of the political power and they are being misused.
Katalin Cech is a Hungarian member of the European Parliament. She represents the Hungarian opposition party, the Momentum Movement. Thanks a lot, Katalin.
Thank you very much.
Chile is putting out the unwelcome mat. The president of Chile announced today that the country will no longer host two major upcoming international summits. They were canceled because Chile is reeling from the country's worst civil unrest in decades. Demonstrators are protesting against social inequality, creating chaos in the streets there. The World's Carolyn Beeler has been following today's news. Carolyn, tell us about the two summits that Chile is no longer hosting.
Carol, Santiago, Chile was set to host the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, or APEC, in mid-November, and the UN's next annual big climate conference, COP25, in early December. Now, at APEC, President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping were expected to meet and sign a sort of preliminary agreement to address the trade war. Right now, there's no talk of when or if that summit will be rescheduled. The UN Climate Summit, on the other hand, is a different story. This is the annual Conference of the Parties, or COP. The UN says it's looking into alternate hosting options for the meeting.
It's really kind of an amazing development. I mean, these mass protests have been gripping Chile for almost 2 weeks. Why did President Sebastián Piñera make this decision today?
These protests just don't show any signs of stopping. The president has ousted much of his cabinet. He's made policy changes. And yet these protests continue.
Carolyn, what was supposed to happen at the UN Climate Summit?
The COP is where top-level diplomats meet to iron out the details of the Paris Agreement. This year was seen as a big preparatory year ahead of next year's summit, where countries are expected to commit to new carbon-cutting goals. World countries are way behind the goal they've set for themselves to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. So next year, they really need to up their promises to meet that goal. And this year was seen as a big year to sort of lean on countries to get them to commit.
So if COP25, the climate change summit, still happens, where is it likely to meet and when?
We don't know yet. It might end up in Bonn, Germany, where the UN's climate office is based, and it may end up being postponed. It was scheduled to start at the beginning of December. But about 25,000 people were expected to attend the COP in Santiago. Just to give you an example of the kind of infrastructure that goes into one of these meetings, the last COP in Poland, about 2,000 workers spent 2 months to build 8 acres of temporary meeting space and exhibit space to host this big meeting. So no matter what happens, it's going to be a scramble.
The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. Thanks a lot, Carolyn.
You're welcome, Carol.
People in Vietnam are anxiously awaiting DNA test results. Many fear that their loved ones may be among the 39 people found dead in a refrigerated container truck last week in England. Investigators suspect the people were being transported as part of a global smuggling ring. DNA samples from the bodies have been sent to Vietnam for identity verification. In central Vietnam, authorities have taken hair and nail samples from families who've reported missing relatives. The BBC's Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
5 hours down the main Trans-Vietnam Highway from Hanoi, the province of Nghệ An, the country's largest, stretching from the coast to the Laotian border, is also one of its poorest. There's a long history of its people going overseas in search of better opportunities. Vietnam's founding father Ho Chi Minh comes from here, and famously once worked in the restaurant kitchens of Paris. Today, overseas remittances bring in around $250 million a year from this province, with Britain a favourite destination. The risks of such dependence on informal migration and traffickers have now been brought home to families enduring the agonising wait for news of missing sons and daughters. Lei Ti Lee begs the British investigators to speed up their work so she can know whether her son, Nguyen Choc Thai, was one of the 39 victims inside the container. Ever since we heard the news about it, we've been so worried, says his father, Nguyen Van Thai. We hope he isn't one of them. We just want him back in Vietnam. The family say they've already given hair and fingernail samples to the local police for DNA identification. Thai left a month ago, travelling first to Germany, from where he called them several times. But they've heard nothing from him for 10 days. An official in their village calls residents to a meeting. Vietnam is still run by the Communist Party, on old authoritarian lines. Yet the showy new houses and cars here, unusual for rural Vietnam, flaunt the money to be made by going overseas, a lure to ambitious young people. Lê Đình Thoan made that journey more than a decade ago. He described how he cut the tarpaulins of fruit and vegetable trucks in France to smuggle himself into Britain. His time there was not a success. He was recruited by gangs to work on a cannabis farm, was arrested, jailed, and deported. Yet 10 years later, and now married with a young son, he still dreams of going back. If both governments would open the gates and make it easier, he says, I would definitely go back, and with my family. Getting to Britain has not lost its appeal in this part of Vietnam, even after this appalling tragedy.
The BBC's Jonathan Head reporting in Vietnam. In Hong Kong, protesters have a new strategy. They're targeting businesses that have voiced support for Beijing. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following this from Hong Kong, and he joins us now. Patrick, what message are the protesters trying to send?
Well, they have what they call a self-proclaimed revolution against Chinese domination, and they're basically telling China to back off. They want to preserve their autonomy. So the peace marches haven't really worked, and now I've seen that they've escalated things and taking it to the next level and become more destructive. So you'll actually see protesters going out and smashing up shops and even setting them on fire. So that sounds bad, and it sounds like hooliganism, right? And that's what the Chinese government has been saying. But actually, it's a well-defined strategy to punish any corporation that is aligned with the Chinese government, which is effectively the enemy of the protesters. There is a crowdsourced list that is uploaded to an interactive map. And essentially, if the CEO or the leader or someone associated with the shareholders of a private corporation says something hostile to the movement, then they can make the list. And on that list now are a sushi chain, a fast food chain that sells beef and rice, a ramen chain, and actually one of the most prominent examples is Starbucks.
Why Starbucks? I certainly don't think of it as a brand that would associate itself with cracking down on protesters.
It all started when these two super wealthy heiresses from Hong Kong went to the UN Human Rights Council. And their message was the protesters are very vicious. And you know, here's a billionaire named Pansy Ho. Her family owns casinos, giving her impression of the protests.
An alarming rate of young children are running away from home to become frontline riot fighters, radicalized to perpetrate criminal acts.
So that's a pretty typical view from someone from the establishment, as she is. So this woman happened to be sitting beside another mega rich woman from Hong Kong named Annie Wu, who had similar things to say about the protesters. And it so happens her family owns the local franchise rights to Starbucks. So pretty soon after that speech, which happened last month at the UN, Starbucks started getting smashed up around Hong Kong. And you know, it wasn't just Starbucks. This woman's family owns a lot of shops, including this bakery, and you can hear people throwing bricks through the window. If you go down the street after a protest, you'll see lots of shops smashed up. Now, again, not the mom and pop store, not some random store that has nothing to do with the protest. It's always on some sort of blacklist, and you can argue about whether or not there should even be a blacklist, but there is a list.
One thing I'm curious about is the kind of the blowback. I mean, the protesters are going after these brands and these companies they think are hostile to them and pro-Beijing. But at the same time, doesn't it work to undermine Hong Kong as a city that wants to be seen as a place for businesses to set up?
The protesters would say, we don't care about the economy right now. We care about our rights. We don't want to be under the authoritarian shackles of mainland China. So they're not worried about that. The establishment is worried about how this makes Hong Kong look. And of course, they're saying it makes them look like rioters. I have to say, every time that they do this, these protesters, they don't steal anything. They're not going in and just grabbing stuff. In fact, at one point, a criminal was taking advantage of their vandalism and destruction at a mobile phone store, and he went in and started stealing phones. Well, the protesters tied him up and left him for the police to catch. In another incident, they smashed the wrong shop. There's a bank called the Bank of East Asia. They smashed that up and then realized the error of their ways, spray-painted, sorry, wrong bank, on the bank. It's not rioting, which is what the Chinese officials like to call it. It's actually, they're sending a political message by doing this.
It's very kind of a surgical strike against a name and a brand. So let's look at the reverse. What about shops and companies and brands that are actively supporting the protesters? How are they faring?
They're doing good because when you look at that interactive map, you can also see the shops and businesses that support the movement. There's a bubble tea shop that just had customers going around the block because they said, we support this movement. In general, the Hong Kong public, if you look at polls, does not seem to be turning against the protesters when they become destructive. We haven't seen the mood shift away from them after they've set certain shops on fire. So I don't think that the overall Hong Kong population is turning their backs on the protesters, and shops that embrace them get rewarded.
The world's East Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thank you, Carol.
Haiti has been paralyzed by protests for weeks. It means that many Haitians, like 44-year-old Magali Dress, are stuck at home in Port-au-Prince.
We're questioning ourselves, how long can we continue being like this because people are running out of basic things like water or food?
That frustration is felt across the country. The world's Alana Gordon has been following the latest events in Haiti and has this update.
Protesters are demanding that the country's president, Jovenel Moïse, step down. They're angry about fuel shortages and government corruption. The unrest and frustration has been growing in recent days. This is the sound of police officers demonstrating in the streets. They're chanting for better working conditions. They say they're doing a difficult job, and the government is taking advantage of them. Their protest was captured on video by Voice of America. After the police came out, factory workers went on strike. Then today, it's healthcare workers. And doctors like Odile L'Esperance. We spoke through the messaging service WhatsApp.
We want to fight against inequality. We want to fight against corruption.
L'Esperance is an OBGYN in Port-au-Prince. He worries people are blaming doctors for not giving adequate care. But he says they're working with what they have.
We want to be able to take care of our patients. We want to have opportunity to give response to the emergency. When you work in a hospital, no gloves. So patient die, this situation cannot continue. Too much money was wasted in this country.
Things have turned violent with the protests in Haiti. It's estimated that about 20 people have been killed and 200 injured. The Committee to Protect Journalists has documented a big rise in the targeting of reporters. Earlier this month, a prominent Haitian radio reporter who was critical of the government was murdered. Human rights groups are calling for an investigation. The country is now in what many Haitians call lock mode. Schools and businesses are closed, and transportation is paralyzed. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
And now let's return to Magali Dress. She owns the company Caribbean Craft in Port-au-Prince. Her business supports more than 100 Haitian artists and supplies crafts to large U.S. chains. A month ago, her store caught fire during a protest and burned down.
I received the image at 2 o'clock in the morning, and at first I thought it was fake news. But when the security guys called and say, Madame Dress, the company is on fire and we're sending you pictures of every single building that is being caught on fire, my reaction was, why is it that Haiti has to suffer so much? It brought me back 10 years ago when I was at a show in Atlanta presenting collections and I got a phone call saying there's a major earthquake. Mm. I felt like I'm going back again to that square one where we fight so much for so little results. This is going on in this country because we are just being led by the wrong people. And I realize that if I am leading a group of the craft sector, I can't let them down. I can't be just like them. I need to really fight for them and fight for a better Haiti.
Now, you mentioned that the leadership of Haiti is wrong. What's wrong with the leadership of Haiti right now?
Well, if we go back to history and for the past 30 years, this country has always been in the news for all the bad reasons. And if we dig into it, we'll all see that it's a lack of leadership. Our leaders are not in office to make this country a better place, but some of our leaders are there for their own personal agenda. The country is put second and the needs of the population are not addressed. And I think that it will continue to remain like this until the right people are assuming the positions for a better Haiti. I love my country, but I also say the future of this country is in the hands of Haitians. And I also strongly believe it's going to be in the hands of Haitian women.
So do you support the protesters in demanding that the country's president, Jovenel Moïse, step down?
100%. I think this president has failed to deliver his promises. He's unable to take control of anything in the country. There's no security. And the whole population now, as you mentioned earlier, whether it's the police or the health providers or the schools or the youth, they're all requesting the same thing. We need to put an end to corruption.
Do you feel safe?
Nobody in Haiti could say that they feel safe. No one. We could only be a little safer when we don't take the streets because we would avoid certain rock throwings or shootings. But I have to say, 4 weeks ago, my car in my house received 2 bullets. So nobody's safe in Haiti.
Is the violence coming from the protesters?
You have a lot of this frustration that is built that makes them become violent in many occasions. But we also have another form of violence where armed gang members who are supported by very well-known powerful people are attacking people or maintaining that fear. So it's all linked to the fight for power. And unfortunately, we have in the middle a population that is being held hostage and is paying the highest price.
Where is all this headed? You've got a country at a basic standstill. You say you're basically stuck in your house right now. You can't go out. You know, your business burned down. What's next?
For the moment, I think that the protests will continue because the president's message did not address any of the questions that are being asked in the streets. It's creating more chaos. And unfortunately, the fear that everybody has for the moment is that we will have more death. We are very much afraid that these opponents and the supporters, the few supporters of the regime, will have some very strong battles. And unfortunately, a lot more companies will suffer and a lot more people will lose their lives.
You're somebody who's had a business that's been destroyed twice in recent years. What gives you hope?
What really gives me hope is really seeing the majority of the population. All they're asking for is an opportunity to be at work. What gives me hope is that this country has everything to create. We have to build this country. It's a country where we need schools, we need businesses, we need everything. And this is the only place, I believe, in the region where an entrepreneur like me could have such a big impact. I am very optimistic because I feel that it's the end of a reign. It's unfortunately very difficult, but I consider it, if a woman is giving birth, we're just going through a very hard time, but we'll have a very healthy baby.
Magali Dress is Haitian and the owner of Caribbean Craft in Port-au-Prince. Thanks a lot, Magali.
Thank you.
Finally, tonight is Game 7 of the World Series. Last week, we told you to keep an eye on rising superstar Juan Soto from the Dominican Republic. Soto has delivered big time for the Washington Nationals.
That is hit in the air to right and way out of here. Wow!
Last night, Soto demolished his third home run of the series. Not a bad way to celebrate a birthday. Soto just turned 21 last week. It's been a weird series between the Houston Astros and the Nationals. In the first six games, the home team lost. Never happened before. The Nationals have left Houston fans silent in their ballpark, and the Astros have returned the favor. Tonight's game is in Houston, a good sign for Juan Soto and the visiting Nationals. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Touch 'em all, Mr. Soto.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.